As we began the book of Esther last week, we set the stage for the scene that is unfolding before us. The first major character brought to light was King Ahasuerus, or as he's often called, King Xerxes. He's a king of what was much of the known world at the time, the Persian Empire. And as we learned without re-preaching the message, he is an egotistical king. A prideful man that no one would ever think to say no to. We described him in chapter 1 last Sunday as large and in charge with no moral boundary whatsoever. As we followed the scripture, we find him soon in a drunken stupor, showing off his power and possessions to the princes and governmental officials of his kingdom. And in the heat of all of this, he requests that his wife, King Vashti, come and parade herself sensually in front of him and his comrades. And of course, the man to whom nobody would ever think of saying no to just gets told no from his wife. She says, "I'm not doing it." So now what we have at the conclusion of chapter 1 is a king with a big head, a drunk mind, a hot temper, and a bad counsel who kicks his wife out of the kingdom. Thus, the king loses his head and the queen loses her crown. When we come to verse number 1 of chapter 2, we fast forward for 4 years. That's where we open up the text, and after examining verse number 1 last Sunday, we pick up today at verse number 2. And I want you to write this first statement down there in your notes. It's the first point, and then we'll read some scripture together. Here's the first statement that I want you to think about. Number 1, we should not be surprised by the exploits of a society that has no fear of God. I want to say that again because I really want you to think about it in the terms of not only the characters here living between two worlds, but you and I who live between two worlds. We should not be surprised. We should not be surprised by the exploits of a society that has no fear of God. Look at it there in the chapter, verse 2. Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, "Let there be fair young virgins sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers to go throughout all the kingdom and gather together all the fair young virgins unto Shushan the palace, to the house of the women, under the custody of Hegai, the king's chamber, keeper of the women, and let their things for purification be given unto them. And let the maiden which pleaseth the king, let her be queen instead of Vashti." And this thing pleased the king. Now, I don't want you to be mistaken by what's going on here. This is not a beauty pageant whereby the king will evaluate the truest qualities of a young lady before proposing marriage to her. This is not what it is. This, friend, is the exploitation of young women by the way of a sex competition. This is an egregious abuse of power. That was once again, as we see here, the result of bad counsel. After all, it was bad counsel who came to him while he was drunk, having a hot temper about his wife refusing him, who said, "Hey, we got an idea. Banish her from the kingdom. And when you banish her, make sure you write a new law that says no wife can ever do to us what she did to you." He liked the idea. That's what he did. And now we see these same bad counselors coming to him and saying it's not right that there's no queen. Remember, 4 years have passed. I don't want you to mistake some type of purity on behalf of King Ahasuerus, as if he was lonely and not bringing women into his chamberlain. You need to get that far from your imagination. This is a guy who got in the bed with anybody that he wanted to, anytime he wanted to. No pure man who's been lonely without companionship for 4 years. They were just concerned about a crown. And if we're going to give a crown to another woman since Vashti's been gone for 4 years, let's have some fun with it. And so these counselors come to him and give him this idea of this egregious competition. It is also obvious, according to verse 3, that this type of harem already existed. Verse 3 says, let the king appoint officers into all the provinces of his kingdom that they may gather together, notice this, all the young virgins to the house of the women under the custody of Hege, the king's chamberlain, who happened to be the keeper of the house of women. So this was not something he was starting. This whole idea of concubines and women living in his kingdom to be used for his pleasure and his pleasure alone, it was already there. A harem already existed. Now, the word harem may be new to you. Let me help you understand what I mean by that. It was a domestic household owned by the king where he would keep his wives, his concubines, and female servants. That's where they would stay. And as we read in the text, he only gathered them when he needed them for his own physical pleasure. And if he called them by name, the keeper of the house of women, Hege, would go and grab them and bring them in for his suit. Now, Kathleen and I, on our recent visit to Israel, we were in the city of David, standing in the old ruins of King David's palace and King Solomon's palace. And while we were standing there, our tour guide said, right there above this palace is what we call the Mount of Corruption. The Bible's already identified this in the Old Testament, the Mount of Corruption. He said, the Mount of Corruption, that's the place where Solomon kept his harem. Solomon built those houses for his wives and his concubines. And that's the idea of what we have here with King Ahasuerus. Verse 12 through 14 tells us exactly how this pageant was going to work. The virgin women were picked by the king's officers and forced to come. There's no indication as to how many were brought before the king. The historian Herodotus, who lived during this time, who recorded a lot of these actions, suggested that there was around 300 that were brought before the king. Verse 12, look at it. Now when every maid's turn was come to go in the king Ahasuerus, after that she had been 12 months. So for 12 months they were prepared. For 12 months they were made ready for their one night with the king. So picture the absurdity of this, the egregious abuse of power. 300 women supposedly forced into coming to this place where for a year they would prepare themselves through nourishment, through physical qualities in such a way that on their one night before the king, that they would be able to please him to the extent that he chooses her to be his new queen. So for 12 months they would go through this. And when it was her turn to spend the night, she could ask for whatever she wanted to try and win the crown. Verse 12 talks about all the things that they did during the 12-month period. Then verse 13 says, then thus every maiden of the king, whatsoever she desired, was given to her to go with her out of the house of the women unto the king's house. And then after her night with the king, she was sent to the concubine's chamber, most likely to never see the king again, unless he requested her by name. That's verse 14. In the evening she went, and the very next day she returned into the second house of the women. The second house of the women is basically, you had your house where the young fair virgins stayed who were being ushered in, estimate 300, one a night for however many nights until the king was satisfied. And then you had the house where the concubines lived who were already used and abused by the king. So once they left this house and had their one night with the king, they would send them into the next house, and they had to stay there. They couldn't go back out in the kingdoms. They couldn't get remarried. They belonged to him. They were of his possession, and they lived there and dwelt there and would only be called upon if he wanted them. And most historians and scholars tell us that in these lives of the kings, they never really even reached out to those concubines ever again. Their lives were forever affected. He used at his disposal. Even though they were not chosen to be queen, they could never be released. And we look at this exploit of women, and we think, wow, how could these things be? But by the way, it was not just the women who were exploited. The boys too. In fact, historians tell us that the Persian Empire alone, under King Ahasuerus' rule, would take over 500 boys a year and make them eunuchs to serve in the king's court. Over 500 a year. So it wasn't just the exploitation of young girls. It was the exploitation of young boys. And the bottom line is this. This worldview of King Ahasuerus and his empire was a worldview with no fear of God. And when there is no fear of God, there comes with this mentality that anything and everything goes. And while the events that we see unfolding before us are heartless, sinful, and egregious, this type of world system can get by with it because they have no fear of God. And that should not surprise us, that when authorities exploit others in their vulnerabilities, when kingdoms abuse people who take their power and use it only for themselves, the weak exploit it. It shouldn't surprise us. Because there is no cognitive presence of God in their minds. And that's why many times a lot of us just waste our energy being upset and confused and surprised by the exploitations of our own country that we live in. Why does it surprise you that both men and women, the poor, the vulnerable, are exploited by a system that has no cognitive presence of God? And how is it that similar exploitation of people can occur in our modern world today? For the very same reason as it did in the Persian Empire. No fear of God. So we read this and we think, this is terrible. I read this and I think, what if I would have been alive in that day? What if somebody walked into my home and took my two girls? And there's a lot of debate that maybe some of these women willingly wanted to go, and I don't doubt that. But I think the text is pretty clear that largely these women were forced to participate. They were taken. The text says they were brought, they were placed under the custody of someone else. So while maybe a few willingly signed up hoping that they would win the pageant, many of them had their doors knocked on, and when they saw their daughters were pretty and fair and beautiful, and this one might be the one that pleases the king, let's bring her in, and for a year we'll make her even more beautiful than she already is, and then we'll force her into the king's house, and he can do whatever he wants to her on that one night. Can you imagine dads living in such a society? Yeah, here we are. Or even with the events of the past couple of weeks in our country, I have two great fears that both my daughters and my sons will be exploited. The fear that men could abuse my girls is great. The fear that my son could be falsely accused of improprieties is great. But when they happen, they should not surprise them, because they have no fear of God. And neither did Ahasuerus. Write down the second statement. It's getting very important to understand, even possibly even confusing. Write down number two. We are reminded how difficult it is for the people of God to exist in such a godless system. We are reminded of just how difficult it is for the people of God to exist in such a godless system. Verse 5 is the first time we meet a Jew, that is the people of God, in this whole narrative. Who is he? He's Mordecai. Look at verse 5. Now in Shushan the palace there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai. He's a Benjamite, the verse says, a descendant of Kish. By the way, I'm not going to tell you who also in the Bible was a descendant of Kish. You ought to do your homework because it'll come up later in our study. There's also a very important figure in the Bible who is a descendant of Kish. I'll let you look that up on your own this week. Mordecai is an exile. He's brought over to the Persian Empire in the Babylonian captivity. It's very clear here, according to verse 5 and 6. He is from Jerusalem, but he's not in Jerusalem, right? He's God's people, but he's not living among God's people in the sense of that world. So here's Mordecai living between two worlds. He's a Jew, not in Jerusalem. He's a Jew in exile that's a part of the Babylonian captivity. It's also here in verse 7 that we are introduced for the first time to Esther. Verse 7 tells us about Hadassah. Hadassah is her Hebrew name. Esther is her Persian name. Another good reminder of the emphasis of the passage, that God's people in the Persian Empire were living between two worlds. That her real name, her given name, the heart of who she is Hebrew, is Jewish, is the people of God. Hadassah, the major medical outlet. You know these things are going to happen for at least the next couple of years, right? The major medical outlet in Israel is Hadassah. Hadassah, that's the name of the hospitals there. Her name means peace and joy. But yet she goes by Esther. Not Hadassah. She's going by her pagan name. She's going by her Persian name. Another example of how difficult it must be to live in such a society where there is no fear of God. Living between two worlds. Verse 7 also reminds us that she's connected to Mordecai because he brought her up. That is, he raised her. They are cousins. We don't know the story, but somewhere along the way, her parents died. She had no one to take care of her, and so Mordecai stepped up and raised her as if, the Bible says in verse 7, that she was his own daughter. And there's another interesting point that brings all of this together, and that is the scripture very determinedly lets us know that she was fair and beautiful. Fair and beautiful, which is an important note how this story is unfolding. So what we have here is a small community of God's people, which Mordecai and Esther are part of, living in this godless Persian empire. Living in this empire where their daughters are exploited. Living in this empire where their sons are exploited. Living in this empire, as we will find out here in just a couple of chapters, where as a people, there were many who wanted to just kill the Jews. Didn't even want them there. Why? Because the Jews got in their way. Their ideas, their philosophies, their orthodoxy. It messed with the world system that they wanted to operate in, the godlessness by which they wanted to govern. And as long as the Jews are here, they're constantly going to be a problem for us. And so, as we will see later on, let's kill the Jews. And Mordecai and Esther are having to live in that arena. how difficult it must have been. I'll ask you a question this morning. How difficult is it for you? Hold on. How difficult is it for you as a follower of God to live in this godless world system that we reside in? Do you find it very difficult at all? In Peter's epistle, chapter 2, he identifies the people of God as strangers and pilgrims. Why? Because we don't belong in this world in the sense this is not our DNA. This is not what we're about. This is not the way that we think. No. Our residency, our citizenship is in the world to come. It belongs to God. He is our authority. He is our king. We think how he thinks. And so Peter said, for us who belong in God's world, we ought to find it difficult to live and breathe in this world. We're strangers. We're exiles. The old hymn writer said, this world is truly not our own. But yet I'm afraid. Far too many of us who profess to follow Christ, we feel real comfortable here. The thought of leaving this world and going to the next, it's something that we fear. And could it be that the reason why we fear it is because we love this world too much? You and I are entering into a generation. Listen to me carefully. We need to help our kids with this because greater they than us are entering into a generation where you cannot profess to be a true follower of Christ without facing the persecution of this society. It will be impossible. And that's why it should not surprise us that the New Testament speaks far more often about enduring persecution as a Christian than it does being blessed with the riches of this world. Because let's be honest, if you're trying to live for God and love Him, this is a difficult place to live. It's a difficult place to live because they don't do things in D.C. the way God would do things. It's a difficult place to live because we're faced with temptations that will never be faced in God's kingdom. It's a difficult place to live because we live in a flesh that we won't have to live in when we are transferred to the world in which we truly belong. This is a difficult place for the child of God to live. And if it's not difficult for you, I'd question whether or not you're really a child of God. That's the point of the passage, not whether or not Esther wanted to be there. The point of the passage is they were placed in a vulnerable situation because it's hard for the people of God to live righteously in a culture that has no fear of Him. So when she comes in verses 8 and 9, she immediately catches the eye of Haggai, keeper of the women, and essentially he moves her to the front of the line. You say, Pastor, I'm struggling a little bit. You know, Esther's here, and there's a lot of things I don't understand. There's some questions here about Mordecai and Esther. We'll get to those in just a moment. But suffice it to say right now, Esther was one of the chosen. She was brought. Mordecai gave her some counsel, good or bad. It's for you to determine. But the counsel was, don't let them know you're Jew, because you'll never get through if you do. They brought her in. Haggai, the keeper of the women, looked at her and said, wow, this one's pretty. I think the king's really going to like her. In fact, we've been at this a long time. We got 300 women. I'd like to close this thing off as soon as we can. Let's move her up to the front of the line. I think the moment he sees her, he's going to put the crown on her head. And so that's what happens in verse 8 and 9. Verse 10 and 11 is where we get into the questionable actions of both Mordecai and Esther, but hold on to that thought. I plan to conclude with a statement about it in a moment. It's in verse 10, Esther had not shown her people nor her kindred. That is, she didn't let anybody know she was a Jew, for Mordecai had charged her that she should not show it. Not only that, Mordecai walked every day before the court of the women's house to know how Esther did and what should become of her. So Esther's thrust into this exploitation. Verses 15 through 20 tells us the rest of the story. I'm not going to go back and read all of it. We did a moment ago, but Esther wins the crown. Look at verse number 17. And the king loved Esther above all the women. Don't be confused with the word love here. This is not a real love. A king Ahasuerus didn't have Esther come into his chamber on her appointed night to please him sexually and look at her and say, you know what, let's not do this because I feel like there's a lot about your God I want to get to know. None of that's happening. They're not asking who their brothers and sisters and moms and dads are. They're not trying to make this intimate, internal connection. Nothing about character. No records are brought up. None of that is being discussed, okay? So when it says the king loved her, it didn't mean he wanted her for who she was. No. He thought she was good looking. That's all that meant. This is nothing more than a lustful attraction to a fair and beautiful woman. Because just like Vashti, Esther would become his next sex object to show off in front of his friends. And I'll be honest with you, this is the hardest part of the story for me. Because I have a lot of questions that the Bible doesn't answer. I have a lot of questions about why Mordecai, who raised this girl, didn't put his life on the line so that she wouldn't be exploited in such an egregious manner. Are you with me? Am I the only one that thinks this? My question is, why did he counsel her to hide her Jewish identity? Because to even be put in this position, you got to understand that they weren't living by the laws of Moses as presented to them in the Pentateuch. They weren't being kosher in their lifestyle, in their eating methods. Nobody knew they were Jews. Nobody. And I got a lot of questions about that. That I would think, at least if I was in that position, that I would say, even if it cost me my life, I'm not going to allow you to take my girl and do this. And why didn't Esther? Maybe she felt the pressure of Mordecai. I don't know. But when she was thrust in that room, why didn't she say, I just need you to know, even if you banish me from the kingdom, I just need you to know I'm a Jew. My name's really Hadassah. But the bottom line here is I believe they face the same struggles that you face when you go to work and you live in your community. It's far more difficult than we like to admit. As God's people, to live in a world in which we do not belong. Under the pressures of such an oppression against people of faith. Write down this third statement. We must see that as a godless culture goes about its business, God's hand remains steadfast in each matter. That's the third statement. We must see that as a godless culture goes about its business, God's hand remains steadfast in each matter. Verse 21. In those days while Mordecai sat in the king's gate. Oh, this is different. It's real different. You're not just sitting at the king's gate for no reason. No, this was a place of position. Somewhere along the way, Mordecai goes from being an average exiled Jew to obtaining a senior position in the king's court. We obviously understand that the providence of God is already being used in this difficult position. That through Esther, no doubt Mordecai, not unleashing their identity, was put in this place of a position in the king's court. And though a difficult situation, God is already using Esther. While sitting at the gate, verse 21, Mordecai overhears of an assassination plot against the king. Why were they angry with the king? I mean, think about who he was. We don't have to have one reason. When you're this kind of king, exploiting the people, showing off your power, doing everything you can only for yourself and not for others, there's a lot of people that ain't gonna like you. We can't just automatically assume that it had to do with this pageant that he had. Maybe, maybe not. The bottom line was two men wanted to cut his head off. And they were talking about it in the wrong place. Because Mordecai overhears it. He goes and tells Esther, because nobody knows yet about the relationship that Mordecai and Esther have. Esther tells it to the king in Mordecai's name. That is, Esther comes to Ahasuerus and says, listen, Mordecai, one of the men who work for you down at the gate, overheard these two men saying they want to kill you. She gives all the credit to Mordecai. And King Ahasuerus does what any egotistical, prideful man would do when you threaten his throne. He takes them and hangs them on a tree. And it was such a big deal that he chronicles the details, as verse 23 tells us. Another interesting note is that Mordecai isn't recognized by the king for sparing his life. Did you notice that? I mean, I would think if somebody came and told me that somebody in the church was going to chop my head off, that I'd at least have a friend out there somewhere to let me know. And if they let me know, then I'm going to take them to dinner and it won't just be McDonald's. I'm going to give them a nice big thank you for telling me that they want to cut my head off. The king doesn't even do that. You notice that? Doesn't even thank him. Now, you may think I'm reading into this, but I think this is just another good point to be reminded that not everything righteous the people of God do will be praised and recognized. You need to understand that as you live for the Lord. Because some of us live the Christian life for praise. We live it for recognition. We're not happy in our environment unless everybody is applauding us for all the righteous things that we do. Not every righteous thing you do is going to be recognized, especially by the godless culture around us. But what is apparent? What is apparent? The hand of God is apparent. That while he's not responsible, that is, God is not responsible for this harem. God is not responsible for this exploitation of women. God is not responsible for this sex competition. And that's not God. But now that Esther's in the position, the hand of God is orchestrating everything to get his people out of Persia. Reminds me of Proverbs 21:1. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. Just as the rivers of water, he turneth it whithersoever he wills. And you believe in the sovereignty of God, and you believe the Bible like that, that God is in control of everything, that his hands are involved in every matter, then you will rest easy tonight, no matter what is going on around us. That even in a godless culture, God is still putting the pieces right where he wants it to be. And sometimes that's for our good in the place of promotion, but sometimes it's for our persecution and our suffering and our abasement. I was working all things out for his plan, even in the hearts of godless people like King Ahasuerus. Living between two worlds. Do you sense the heart of the text and how this resonates with our life today? I don't stand for this. I don't believe this. This is not who I am, but yet I live in a world that is consumed by it. Let me give you one more, and this is where we'll close. I want to address those questions. Here's the statement. Number four, we cannot look to anyone else as the heroes of the stories we read except God himself. Look at that statement again. We cannot look to anyone else as the heroes plural there, as the heroes of the stories we read except for God himself. I'll be the first to admit that several actions by both Mordecai and Esther caused me to scratch my head in disbelief and uncertainty at best. My wife and I discussed this for a little bit of time last night. To even be in this position, men, as I said a moment ago, they weren't living kosher by the law of Moses in their eating, in their worship, and other Jewish requirements. There's no way they could have been. They would have been marked as Jewish people, but nobody knew they were Jewish people. And I look at this and I'm asking myself the question, why? Why did Mordecai insist that she withhold her identity? Why didn't Esther refuse to participate, even if it meant persecution in the egregious nature of the king's improprieties? And you know why we struggle with this? Because you and I, who belong in that world, yet live in this world, we're always looking for heroes. We're looking for people that we can post up on the pedestal and say, yes, that's who I want to be. That's who I need to follow. That's the morality I need to pattern my life after. And we do that with the people in the Bible. We want to, as women, to promote Esther because we'll know later what she does. But at the same time, we look at her morality and we scratch our heads and think, well, maybe she's not one I should follow. We men want to look at Mordecai and say, oh, what a good man. He raised his daughter and put her, but yet he raised his daughter to hide her identity and he pushed her to be involved in this abusive power. What is going on here? Now God will use them, yes. And we want them to be heroes. But listen to me very carefully. I've concluded personally, and maybe you come to a different conclusion. If so, I'd love to hear it. But I have concluded that if they are heroes, they are at best heroes of questionable morality and orthodoxy. At best, questionable. But then again, this is where God challenges me. Because even with the heroes of the Bible who have few scars like Joseph, lived upright and was the best sibling you could ever have, and yet his brothers wanted to kill him. And through all that persecution, he forgives, and we look at that and we want to, Joseph, man, that's who we need to be. That's great and all. But the hero of the story back in Genesis was not Joseph. The hero of the story was God. That God preserved Joseph, that God orchestrated all the events to be able to feed his people during a time of great famine and dearth. That the hero's not Joseph, the hero's God. God just used Joseph. And the same is true with people who have a few more scars than Joseph has. God is still the hero of the story. I don't think it's wise that we make Mordecai or Esther's the heroes or even the examples of morality to follow. I think we look to it and we praise God. That when it is as difficult as it was for Mordecai and Esther to live in a godless society where they didn't make decisions that maybe that we think should have been made when they were living in that environment, that God even then used them. Turn this whole mess into saving his people. Friend, God is always the hero of the story. And so it is even today. We're looking for some hero who will stand up and be a voice for us. Why are we looking at that? Why don't we trust God and let God do his thing? He is always the hero. And my question to you this morning is, do you know this God who can take the mess you've made of and turn it into a graceful blessing of his love and mercy? I say to you as a child of God that as I, and I know you as well, wake up every day trying to do our best to have the mind of Christ in a world that rejects Christ. To stand where we believe the Bible wants us to stand in a world that hates the Bible. To know that you're not alone. That as long as people have existed in this sinful world, there has always been a struggle living between two worlds. But we must resolve that yes, we are strangers. Yes, we are pilgrims. We do not belong here. Therefore, we keep our eyes on the world that is to come. And we raise our children in such a manner that they will not love this world, neither the things of this world, for one day the world will be destroyed. As Paul said in Romans, that we will not be conformed to this world, but rather that our minds will be transformed into the image of Jesus Christ, that we'll live not for the riches of this earth, but for the riches of the world to come. Because every day of our life we're torn, living between two worlds. But maybe it's just a fair reminder today, even in the climate in which you and I live today, to understand this world is not our home. We rest. We rest in the world that is to come. And until it comes, may we do our best to live with integrity and biblical conviction. Let's stand together for prayer.